Tacoma cannabis activist, researcher, and educator, and I am joined by my co-host from Oregon, who is a veteran and cannabis activist, Uncle Dig. How you doing today, Uncle Dig?
I am doing great. It is a beautiful sunny day outside, and we've had a lot of rain, so my plants are happy and clean.
Yeah, the summer is coming on nice, and just about another week to official summer, and so we have the rainy days here in Washington State with a little sun, and we are hoping everybody has their plants in the ground. You know, we've talked before, really June 1st is kind of the cutoff for that, but I'm guessing you could still get something in the ground and get a little plant or seed going. You'd probably get like an eighth off it or something. What do you think, Dig?
I think if you're in the right place, you can go as late as June 15th, but we're past that. So anything you put in the ground right now is going to have trouble catching up. But if it's a choice between, you know, growing and not growing, you know, put that dish out there, man. Let's grow it.
Yeah, it's still fun to do even the small plants. And we are glad to be back on the show, and I just wanted to let the audience know of something interesting that I've been doing. I'm starting up a cannabis caucus within the Democratic Party here in Pierce County. So if you are somebody who is leaning to the left with your politics and you want to get involved a little more with cannabis, hit me up at lucasbarfield@gmail.com. That's Lucas with a K. And get you signed up for the cannabis caucus. And what we're going to try to do, Dig, is just agitate a little bit more in the Democratic Party on this topic of cannabis. As we've talked about before, you know, Democrats, they do well on some things, but this cannabis issue has not always been their best foot forward.
Yeah, there's a lot of criticism from the left, honestly, that you can make of the Democratic Party on cannabis. We can talk about patient access and how even in Democrat-led states, patient access has diminished with legalization. And we can see from the Democratic Party leadership, i.e. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, that while they may sometimes say some pro-cannabis things to get the electorate fired up, they are leaving it up to local Democratic Party places in states, if at all, to champion the plant, i.e. they are not doing a good job in the green area of politics.
Yeah, and speaking of not doing a good job, we are going to move to our first story, and that is over in California, and just an unbelievable story out of California, Dig. I am scratching my head on this as somebody who has an environmental degree. This is just crazy what's going on in California. So what they are doing in California, people have been paying attention. California legal market is struggling, and it is really highly and a bit overregulated. And what they are doing is California just passed in their budget. They're going to give towns and cities $100 million to then divvy out to these cannabis licensees. So there's two types of licensees going on right now in California. You have the provisional, and then to get an annual or a permanent license, Dig, you have to get, quote unquote, out of the LA Times, a very costly environmental review. Now, as I said, I have an environmental degree, and I'm very happy that businesses have to do environmental reviews and things like that, but to place this burden on this new industry, it looks like it's not working, Dig, in California.
Well, and honestly, look, we've all, first of all, let's talk about this environmental inspection. Any you know, second year college student from an environmental studies class could perform a lot of these labs that they're charging these businesses exorbitant amounts of money to do. So that's your first hustle that shouldn't be allowed, and that's capitalism for you. That's rent seeking, right? And then now you've regulated that market to the point where there's a lot of turnover. Businesses start and fail because they run out of liquid capital to get started. So the consistency of the product isn't there. So what you end up happening, because you've regulated and you've taxed this to death. By the way, we're not regulating efficiently or well. We're just doing too much of it. We're not doing any of it well, but we're doing too much of all of it. It means the quality of the product goes down while the price to produce and purchase goes up, also the tax burden. So what happens is, an example of this in California, Washington as well has this problem to a lesser degree, is that you end up with a black market that provides a superior product to the legal market, even though you have to pay more for the legal product, which is something you don't want to create, and which is just been a symptom of a of governments who want to regulate an industry they refuse to understand.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was thinking too. It really is, they are just regulating too much, and what that is doing is encouraging, because what they're trying to do is they're saying, well, we want to make a highly regulated cannabis market to get rid of the underground market, but what they're in fact doing is encouraging it. One of the statistics that's just kind of crazy is, you know, they passed legal cannabis in 2016 in California. 82% of cannabis businesses in California still have a provisional license simply for the fact they cannot afford this environmental review. And one of the things that I think they're missing too with the environmental reviews is, you know, there is an issue with water and cannabis, and there's also an issue with pollution with all the pesticides and things like that. But the biggest issue with cannabis, and this is going to be later our guest, Dr. Evan Mills, the biggest issue with cannabis is the indoor growing. And I don't think they're even really looking at that with these environmental reviews, or as much as they should, because they have massive indoor grows going up in California. And so, as you said, they're just over-regulating this, and what we're ending up with is just a big, giant mess.
Yeah, and that's not even to really, like, really harp on the fact that instead of making California money, now the legal market seems to be costing California money.
Yeah, I made that observation, too, yep.
And I just, I don't know what the answer is moving forward. And attempts in the California legislature have been moved forward to try to improve the situation. They have failed due to intense opposition. Intense effort in the Washington legislation has attempted to make home grow legal in Washington and to free up some of the barriers to access and limit the tax burden and make your businesses that are legal more competitive with the illicit market. They all failed due to conservative opposition within and without the Democratic Party. So really what we're seeing is that politicians are setting up the legal market to fail because they don't want cannabis to be accessible, is what it looks like to me. I don't know what other conclusion to draw from this.
Yeah, it really looks like they almost want it to not work. But they're getting so much tax money, so I'm not sure that could be the case, and I don't want to be sound like a big conspiracy theorist, but it really seems to me like they're just, you know, it's they've been basing cannabis prohibition on white supremacy, on pharmaceutical supremacy for over 100 years. And I just feel like these chickens are coming home to roost, and it's really sad to see there's going to be a whole lot of people and their businesses getting caught up in this. And speaking of big problems and not really knowing what's going to happen, we want to move on to our next story, which came out of Michigan. We just want to touch on it for a minute, what is happening in Michigan. And Michigan is just the latest state to try to regulate what is called Delta 8 THC. And have you heard of this stuff, Dick?
Yeah, I've heard of it, and I've had an edible that was based on this that my buddy at a smoke shop gave me, and to me, compared to cannabis, it was almost more like taking a melatonin before you go to bed. I wasn't very impressed with it, yeah. But I can see why people in legal states are excited about it.
Yeah, well, I've heard from medical people in the medical cannabis realm that Delta 8 helps people because it's not as strong, and so it doesn't give people the anxiety and things like Delta 9 THC. And just to recap to the audience what Delta 8 THC is, and Delta 8 THC is actually an artificial cannabinoid they are making from CBD. So the backstory is just real quick, is they overproduced hemp because they freed hemp, Dig. Just like we should the THC cannabis plant, they freed the hemp plant, which is the same plant, just a artificial THC limit on it. But they just let everybody grow it who could get a license. And so they had a glut of hemp, which led to a glut of CBD. I've heard of warehouses full of like 50-gallon drums of CBD sitting around the United States.
Oh, the hemp harvest last year, they left it out too long. I think half of it rotted into the ground. And
yeah, they just had so much. And so they are not going to just let that CBD go to waste. And so they got the chemists going, and the capitalists figure out a way to change all that CBD into Delta 8. And the Delta 8 simply means is the double bond in the molecule is on the 8th carbon bond instead of the 9th like Delta 9. Just to make that differentiation there. And like you said, it's kind of a weaker cannabinoid. It's not as great, but like we were saying with the hemp, it's just wide open. I made a call down to Panama City, Florida the other day to talk about some hemp pre-rolls with somebody for a minute, and the guy was trying to sell me Delta 8 on the phone, saying, hey, you can come down here, and we have Delta 8 here in the store on Panama City Beach. You cannot buy THC cannabis like that. So it's really putting the THC farmers, the THC purveyors at a big disadvantage, and it's just getting started, Dig.
I see a lot of farmers are concerned about this, and I would be too if I was tied up in the legal industry and not just a medical hobby grower at home. But what I will say is I feel that this is going to be more of a fad. It might last a little bit longer, but it's going to be a lot like spice or like a lot of those other legal workarounds. Like, I can't have cannabis, so I'll just have this. If we can keep legalization going, where people and limit the employer's ability to legislate your off time and what you do in it, i.e. they stop testing for cannabis, if we can get rid of that, if we can do those two things, Delta 8 will continue to just be a limited fad thing in legal states because they can't get the real deal. But if the empire strikes back, as it were, right?
Yeah.
And we start having these backhanded attacks against patient access, and they continue to figure out ways to regulate it to make it harder to produce and harder to sell and harder to move around the country, then maybe Delta 8 will gain a foothold. But that kind of depends on the way the not only the industry but the movement at large kind of goes.
Yeah, and another concerning thing, and I'm not going to talk much about this because I'm just kind of learning about this, is they also took all that CBD, Dig, and they are converting that to Delta-9 THC. And apparently you can't tell the difference between artificial Delta-9 and Delta-9 just right off the cannabis plant. And this is becoming a disruptor in the market, and apparently it's been going on for a couple of years. I'm going to an LCB meeting today at 2 o'clock, so next episode we'll have an update on this. But this is another thing, like we were saying, unfortunately for a lot of farmers and people who put a lot of time in this cannabis business, it's just a lot of over-regulation, over-policing.
Right.
It's the chickens are coming home to roost, and it's really sad to watch.
It is, but there are ways that you can kind of support your farmers, and there's ways that they hide these products, right? If you get real cannabis flower, i.e., bud, it's not gonna be chemically derived, right? So far, I haven't heard of anyone buying a bunch of hemp and spraying it down with artificial Delta 9. I'm sure they'll start doing that eventually, but no one's doing it yet, right? So buy flower and make your edibles and tinctures and stuff at home, and then you know that you're getting organically derived cannabis.
Support That's how you know. Cannabis farmers. And that is the push right now in Washington State to fight back against this, is they want to open up the farms to customers where we can go down to the farm and hang out and buy half a plant right there on the farm and take it home with us just like you would any other commercial agricultural product.
Yeah, like you go in with your father-in-law and buy half a cow. You buy a subscription box to a local farm and they bring you like, you know, spring onions, and then later you get like summer squash and like whatever they're growing, you just get a big pile of it.
Yeah, we're subscribed to that, or like the pumpkin patch. And they have that with hemp right now where you can go down and cut a hemp plant down for $70. So we need to open this up to the farmers.
Paying people to trim.
What was that?
So I just laugh, like paying people to go trim weed. It's just
weird. Yeah, and this is where the industry's wanting to go. And, you know, it could, some of these Delta 9s and Delta 8s could lead to a really good thing. And speaking of a good thing, our next story is a story I've covered a little bit, and that is the DEA has finally decided, after all these years, and MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, they've been suing the DEA for many years to try to get this thing dropped. The DEA has given up their monopoly on growing research-grade cannabis. And dig... Tell the audience where all these years they've been growing research-grade cannabis in the United States.
They've been, and I think it's the University of Mississippi. Now, I know it's a farm in Mississippi, and they grow what can only be described as a Mexican farmer's worst nightmare. So if it's just the – it's notoriously bad cannabis. Mids off the street would be an improvement off this cannabis. You'd feel like you were on cloud nine. When the federal government lost a court case and certain very sick patients were allowed medical cannabis, but the government and the DEA wanted a monopoly on producing that federally legal cannabis. And I think this was back in the 70s. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yep.
But they started growing these weed possible, and that's what they've been using in all this research studies. It's covered in bugs. It's not well grown. It's not cured properly. It's not very potent. It's garbage. So this is a good thing.
Yeah, and they actually, somebody who I interviewed at HempFest, somebody by the name of Elvie Musica, I think that's her name, she was getting cannabis. It was a couple of patients did a lawsuit back in the 70s, and they were actually prescribed cannabis, and she's been getting like a pack of joints from this place every month for years and years. And she finally, I saw the other day, I was reading that she decided she wasn't going to get it there from anymore because it's so terrible, because she can get good cannabis in Oregon, dig. So she finally gave it up. But it's just interesting how they're growing all the cannabis in Mississippi, which is one of the places where it's just, it's almost like a slap in the face that they would grow it there. But you know why I think it's grown there? Is because that used to be like the center of hemp country. That was hemp country back before the marijuana the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937, all through there, through Louisiana, hemp, all that was grown there. And so it was still kind of there. And speaking of Mississippi, I don't know if the audience has heard, and we've covered this quite a bit, and we just want to bring everybody an update, a terrible story out of Mississippi. The Mississippi medical cannabis law has been overturned by the Mississippi Supreme Court. And I have to bow my head to dig there for a minute, because he was saying he predicted it was going to happen. I was saying, oh, no, they're not going to do that, dig. And sure enough, the Mississippi court said, out of here. No medical cannabis for Mississippi.
I'm not happy I was right. I just the South is deeply patriarchal, right? Like a lot of conservative places, it's run by a bunch of crusty old men. And crusty old men who run the South don't like cannabis. And they have found a way in a lot of these more dominion-y style states to kind of subvert any people power process to make any lasting change. You're seeing this with the voter laws coming out now. And you also saw with this judge overturning this decision. And oh, by the way, they got rid of their whole public referendum system, i.e., you cannot put an initiative on the ballot anymore in Mississippi, because that's how bad they wanted to get rid of cannabis. They got rid of the people's power to affect government to make sure cannabis wasn't legal in Mississippi.
Well, it was kind of an accident, but that is what they did. It was a federal court decision that said, hey, you got to fix their system. They never did. And then all of a sudden they figured that out and threw it all out with the cannabis bill. So they accidentally came upon all this, dig, which is really sad. But there's still lots of cannabis in Mississippi, but sadly people are going to be still getting arrested. That's the big deal, and patients are going to still have a problem getting their medicine. So one of the sickest parts of the country is just going to stay one of the sickest parts of the country, and we hope that something kind of comes out of that. But they're still going forward with a lot of you know, I'm going to see what happens, though, because a lot of the Mississippi medical cannabis people are still going forward. And I think there's going to be like an underground thing going on a little bit more in Mississippi that they might have a hard time stopping.
Well, yeah, because once people vote and you tell them their vote doesn't matter, even people that voted against are be like, we're going to be like, a lot of people are pretty fair-minded down south. And so if they lose...
It passed by them, like 70-something percent.
Yeah, so a lot... I don't think they're going to have... And people who Yeah, it's going to be a problem. I wouldn't rat on your neighbor if they're growing in Mississippi, because all your neighbors might be mad at you then.
Yeah. So let's hope things improve down there in Mississippi on multiple levels. But to move back up here to the west, and this is actually a good story out of Montana. Speaking of conservative states, Montana passed I-109 in November, and it said they had the adult use. And then some bozo came along and did a lawsuit against that with a group called Wrong for Montana.
Yep.
And Wrong for Montana, this is kind of funny, I have to say. Wrong for Montana filed a motion to dismiss their own lawsuit, Dig, after the legislator fixed the mess. I just think it's kind of funny that they wanted to dismiss their own lawsuit.
Well, I think they realized that once they saw like how well the, because you know, they kind of figured out how well the referendum actually did, and once they found out, unlike the people in, you know, people in positions of power in Mississippi, they decided to allow, you know, Montanans to have their say. And so I think that's admirable of them to drop that lawsuit. I don't think they ever should have brought it, but I am not going to crap all over someone who sees the light and decides to do the right thing when they've been doing the wrong thing, because now they're doing the right thing, and that's great. But good for them.
You got a little ahead of yourself there, Dick, because I didn't finish my story.
Oh, no. What'd they do?
Nope. He's not giving up the fight. He still says that Montana's got tricked, and he's still going to try to right the wrong that happened in 2020. So, you got a little ahead of yourself there, Dick.
Okay, I take that back. Man, you know, I would just like for one time me to give someone the benefit of the doubt, like, who's anti-cannabis, and for me to not eat my words for doing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was sounding good there for a minute, but nope. this fella said nope. He posted on their website, Wrong for Montana, they are going to still keep coming after this. I don't know what they're going to do about it now. And Montana has home grows, and it's going to be a great thing there to be able to go out there in nature and buy an eighth of some really good cannabis before you hit that hiking trail.
Oh, man. Once they get growing, too, in Montana, there's going to be no stopping it. After a couple harvests, it's going to be part of their culture, just like it is there in Oregon. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So that's good news out of Montana. Now, we're going to get on to our guest, and who we have on today is Dr. Evan Mills, who's going to talk to us today about energy use and climate change in cannabis. Jeremy Moberg of the Washington State Sun Growers Association is introducing Dr. Evan Mills, and he is speaking at the Washington State Sun Growers Association 2021 Cannabis Cup.
I wanted Dr. Evan Mills as our keynote speaker because it really is so important to understand the scientific basis behind the sustainability issues in cannabis. And here, 4 years later, we finally get the opportunity to get Dr. Evan Mills here. And so it's with great honor that I introduce a real personal hero to me, Dr. Evan Mills. Thank you, Dr. Evan Mills, for taking your time to speak to such an important issue and to continuing to do it without getting paid, really just taking this on as something that you knew needed to be done, that where we can really make true change and true impact through education. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Evan Mills.
Hey, Jeremy, thank you so much for that really nice introduction, and Crystal as well, and for all your efforts to create your association. That history was really interesting, Jeremy. It's a great kind of segue, you know, into this. I guess, first of all, here we are on Earth Day, and, it is a bizarre juxtaposition now of Earth Day and Weed Day, just 2 days apart, or Earth Week and Weed Week, whatever. And that's, you know, you're all very aware of that. Jeremy was very eloquent in starting to explain why that is. So meanwhile, I'm bringing coals to Newcastle. You know, I'm here to talk to you guys who are, you know, you are the hub of an incredibly important and potent climate solution. You know, the slides you're about to see will kind of put that into kind of sharper focus for you. But you are what it's all about. You are exemplifying that we don't have to trade off lifestyle or quality of life or recreation or medicine for the climate. We do trade them off if we grow indoors, but that's not a necessary thing. And this is a much broader important message that we don't have to have colder houses in winter and warmer overheated houses in summer and so on and so forth. We can have our lifestyles and also be climate friendly if we're conscious about it. So my aim in the next few minutes is to just help illustrate the specific reasons that sun-grown is not just the best, but it's really the only way to sustainable way to grow cannabis. And so I'll just kind of jump into it, but be proud of what you do. And for those of you who cultivate indoors, you know, thank you for being here, for listening, for obviously having an open mind. It's full of nuance. This isn't a topic to oversimplify. There's a lot of reasons indoor happens. But let's go forward. So do you want to see, I'm going to share my screen. Is that what I'm doing? Or are we already good, Crystal, with that process?
Yeah, you should need to share your screen.
Okay, so, and then I'm going to pick... I don't know, there's the keynote, I'm gonna share, and then I'm gonna go into present play mode, and we should have a nice full screen of words and pictures.
Looks good.
Okay.
Looks good.
So Earth Day and Weed Day are an odd couple. I did just post yesterday a piece on Medium that you can get to through my website in the lower left with the same title, just kind of summarizes what I'm gonna say here today to you all, and you'll notice I used a picture of one of your favorite members there who needs no introduction. There's Jeremy on the left, and there's a 55 acre proposed indoor grow on the right, and we'll come back to that in a minute. Last month I had a piece in Slate that was kind of a complimentary piece that started to kind of unpack and debunk some of these kind of urban myths about why indoor is superior, and feel free to take a look at that too. These are all, you can find these from my website or just from Googling around. So here's a picture I found just a week or so ago. It's the perfect picture today because this is, I mean, part of the broader backdrop, right, is that your customers, your consumers, and all the intermediaries are largely living in a climate denial even today. And much less than before, but it's still the backdrop problem is, you know, is climate change really happening? Is it caused by humans? But most importantly, at this point, most people believe that or know that. I shouldn't say believe, but know it factually. But then what can I do? So most people see it's the factories, it's the trains, it's the airplanes. They don't really think about their own consumption choices when, in fact, they are a very large slice of the overall human carbon pie. So anyway, this is a fire in called the Eagle Creek Fire a few years ago, 30,000 acre fire just across the river from this golf course in Washington State. So here's your own state. Everybody's out there playing golf while this 30,000 acre wildfire rages. First, I thought this was maybe one of those fake photos, but this was in CNN. This is a real thing that happened. And then you'll see the gentleman with his head in the ground in the lower left, and we'll come back to him a little bit later. So many of you may have seen this piece. This was in the paper that Jeremy mentioned that I published, first a white paper in 2010 or 11, and then in an academic journal in 2012, and just breaking down, like, how much energy is used for indoor, where does it go, what's the carbon footprint? So we get about cannabis, indoor cannabis being on average, big range, your mileage may vary, 4,600 times its weight in CO2. 4,600 times its weight in CO2. This is the CO2 primarily from the energy to run lights, AC, dehumid, curing, everything else, and some transportation. So there aren't many products that emit upwards of 5,000 times their own weight in CO2. And so this is what kind of got this conversation started. This is a beautiful piece of work that came out from Summers et al. Just last month from the University of Colorado. And they took this to another whole level and modeled cannabis carbon footprint for the whole country, looking at key drivers of how clean or dirty is the grid, and then what is the weather, and what are the choices for heating and the need for heating in the winter. But when lights are off, you know, of course it's 12 or 18. The rest of the time, if it's 40 below outside or 120 above, you got to heat and air condition. And so this is really fascinating. And they came, you see, Illinois is like ground zero. That's a combination of cold winter, but also that the grid is just incredibly dirty there. Lots of coal in the making of electricity. It was gratifying that this range that they came up with, 2,200 to 5,200 times its weight in CO2, did bracket the numbers that I developed with a much more simple method, you know, a decade ago. And also, don't be deceived by the nice light yellow in Western Washington. You guys in the East are a little more trouble, but California is very light. But that's still over 2,000 times its weight in CO2. So this is a real problem everywhere. Jeremy started to mention some of these equivalencies. It's very important. The numbers I just gave you, they're very abstract, right? So here's a few of these kind of equivalencies. One number that I just figured out recently is that on a pound-for-pound or weight-for-weight basis, a gram of cannabis, producing a gram of cannabis indoors, uses 400 times as much energy. I think the number is actually 500. I think that's a typo there. Say 500 times it's as much energy as smelting aluminum. So that process you see there of making those aluminum ingots per unit weight, I mean, obviously one of those bricks there weighs, you know, multiple kilos, but on a per unit basis, it gives you a different kind of feeling of how energy intensive this process is. As Jeremy mentioned, a joint is like driving many, many miles in an efficient car. This also varies depending on where you are, and especially if you've got an electric car, it depends how clean the grid is. Nationally, those numbers were in 2012 when the last piece came out, equal to 3 million cars of CO2. So I estimated at the time that there's about 15 million tons of CO2 emissions for indoor cannabis cultivation in this country. That's the same as the emissions of about 3 million cars. Bringing it down more to a consumer level, because that conversation is really critical. I mean, the car example is an individual consumer perspective. Another number, the little pie chart down below the car, if you look at Colorado, which is the highest per capita average consumption state and not the best grid, if you look at the carbon footprint of the individual average individual cannabis consumer in Colorado, their footprint from their consumption equals 60% of their home's carbon footprint for everything else, refrigerators, lighting, clothes washing, remarkably significant. For the state of Colorado, the authors of the Summers paper made the calculation that there's more CO2 emitted from cannabis cultivation than there is from the state's coal industry. Now, the state's coal industry, it's not the largest state in the union for coal, but they have a serious coal production industry in Colorado. So that's pretty astounding. So there are a lot of ways to slice and dice the data, but it's very important to bring these abstract numbers down to some terms that people can understand. Here's another one, just how much energy does a cannabis facility use per square foot per year compared to other facilities that are more familiar? And you can see homes and regular commercial buildings, the first two little blue bars there. So those are like 50 and 100 times less energy per square foot than a indoor cannabis grow is using. And there you see other types of commercial buildings there that, of course, vary. The most energy intensive of them are restaurants, aka food service, and they're still using, you know, a 20th or a 10th as much as indoor cannabis. So one thing that comes out of this picture is that we can't just kind of get out of this mess with energy efficiency. I'm an energy efficiency guy. That's my home field, energy efficiency in buildings. And normally we can do a lot, and we can bring buildings to what we call today net zero energy use, meaning all the energy needed in the building can be produced on site with typically solar electric panels. That is often possible and being done today, but you can't do that when you have this much energy intensity, and we'll explain why in a minute. So you need to first, if you're going to go to net zero, you need to bring energy demand down, and then you start investing in solar. But with this red bar here, you just can't bring that low enough with energy efficiency without going outdoors to be able to do solar. And here's what makes that point. So this is the upper inset, and the right is that 55-acre enclosed indoor grow cannabis industrial park proposed for Blythe, California. Has not been built yet, as far as I know, but they're looking for investors, have done all the design, they have their prospectus. The map, the Google view, is Blythe. It's right there at the Colorado River on the right of the yellow square, and Arizona border is there. Agricultural area, because they're pulling a lot of water out of the Colorado. That grow, which is 2.4 million square feet, would represent that black square that you see, and that's actually exactly where the property is. The yellow around the black square is the area of solar panels that would be required, according to my numbers of the original paper, to zero out that carbon footprint. Now, people can and should debate, well, how much energy do we really need? Can we lower this? Are those numbers too low because now the industry is a lot more clever and efficient? Those are all conversations we can have, but take a look at this and how impossible this is to do. And among other things, I've made the orange shading somewhat translucent. You can see the farmland would be displaced. So one thing that comes out of this is that from a land use perspective, you know, normally one of the arguments that the indoor industry will use is that, well, we use less land per pound or per unit weight produced because we get our 5, 6, 7 harvests in a year and we're more intensive. You know, not if you really count, if you're going to be sustainable and offset with solar, even if that solar is somewhere else, which we'll get to in a second, that's way more land than you need to grow the same amount outside with the, you know, advanced methods that Jeremy was talking about. So this is really important. I had a professional industrial solar designer run these numbers for me. And in this case, it was 25 times the roof area. 25 times the roof area. And if you're a greenhouse, then it's 26 times the roof area because you can't put solar panels on the top of a greenhouse. So this is kind of some of the inconvenient truth of all this. So then the next question that's asked was, well, let's just clean up the grid and we can do the solar panels somewhere else or wind farms. And so it's a fair question. I got curious about this. Many of you have heard of Coachella Valley in the California desert. That's become a major indoor growing mecca, mostly due to very favorable regulation that's been set or not set there. And I got very curious. This is also an area that is one of the largest epicenters of wind energy in California. And they have about 2,300 wind turbines. These are big wind turbines. These are like 100-foot tall, you know, towers. The second chart there, the second photo, those blue shadings are where all the wind farms are. Palm Springs is in kind of the lower right-hand corner of that picture. So major wind epicenter. I think it's about 10% of all California's wind power, and California is a leading state. So I started to do the math on this. And it was pretty stunning. Looking at these shaded squares on the right, they're all kind of to scale. The dark orange is the energy used by all the cannabis indoor cultivation that's been built so far in these cities, Cathedral City, Desert Hot Springs, Indian Wells, Rancho Mirage, and so on. The dotted green line with the green star, that's the wind energy produced today in Coachella Valley. And the other green dotted line way up near the top is the wind energy produced in all of California. The black line between those two is the electricity would be used if all the entitlements that have been improved for Coachella Valley were built out. And so what you see is that if Coachella Valley just finishes what it started, it'll be using basically 7 times as much energy as all the wind turbines in that area, and almost as much energy as the entire state of California. So, or actually, I'm sorry, at build out, I'm sorry, this middle square is what's in development or proposed. All the entitlements are the outermost box. So if they build out all the entitlements, more energy needed than all the wind power in California. This is not sustainable. We can't afford, it took decades to build up all this wind power, right? We can't afford to all of a sudden reroute all of this to this industry that wasn't even on anybody's mind when wind development started, you know, in the 1980s. So cleaning up the grid isn't enough either. So what we're left with is we can't fix this with efficiency. We can't fix this with renewables either. We're optimizing the suboptimal, you know, is the term I like to use, or putting lipstick on a pig. So that's kind of the story, and just a couple more slides. The one thing to leave you with, which is kind of difficult, is that, but also a worthwhile challenge, and one that I know you all are up to, is that if you stand, we're just talking about cultivation so far, right? But there's a broader energy life cycle and footprint of the whole process, the whole value chain. And so these are things that are potentially common to both indoor and outdoor cultivation. And they need to be looked at, just like, you know, nobody's singling out cannabis. We need to look how we produce food. We need to look how we produce cars. We need to look how we design our houses, how we make potato chips. You know, everything's got to be looked at. There should be no double standard, no free ride. We can't solve it with doing one thing. We have to look at all the uses of energy. So these will all be familiar to you, but there's transportation, you know, moving around equipment, moving around people, moving around final product. There's all the inputs. Again, these don't have to be carbon users, but if you have soil made at a distance or using artificial grow media, which isn't typical, I'm sure, for your community, although perhaps rock wool cubes are used to start the babies. I don't know. Those are made with melted rock, and it adds about 10% to the indoor grow carbon footprint if you count the rock wool for internal grows. What are the fertilizers? It's a lot of organic fertilizers that still use energy. You've hopefully read Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, which goes into some of that. And then there's curing and preserving, and one of your members, whose names I won't disclose, just told me he put in a giant refrigerated container, you know, on his beautiful sustainable outdoor site. And, you know, it's an issue, and like we've heard, we need it available all year round and so on. But there's energy there. Now, the good news is that we can carbon neutralize loads like that on site. You know, you can have enough PV panels to zero out a freezer. You just can't zero out a whole indoor grow. Anyway, then there's the retail. And then the big picture there is the extracts and preparations. That's a distillery for CBDs, is my understanding. And I don't know how much energy they use. Nobody's ever looked at that or written about it. I mean, the owners have a power bill, but I've never seen, this is one of the frontiers that needs to be looked at. That's obviously a very energy intensive process if you look at it. Sorry, one more thing is water. I just want to step away from energy for a second and talk about water. One of the big arguments also given for indoor being superior to outdoor is also bogus. You guys win, because to make electricity takes a lot of water, especially ironically hydroelectric electricity, because there's enormous evaporation. But also those cooling towers you see on the left, that's not smoke coming out of a power plant. That's the cooling, the evaporative cooling of the power plant water after the turbines have been run. And so my calculations are that it takes between 20 and 40 gallons a day per plant to cultivate indoors if, you know, it's only a gallon or whatever direct irrigation. But if you look at all this water footprint, it's way more than outdoor cultivation. So you win again, but these are things that the, like Jeremy said, the consumers are just uneducated, and the regulators are uneducated about. So last slide is just what to do, you know, what's needed, some things for you as individuals, for your organization. You know, back to the beginning, be proud of what you're doing. You have a lot of bragging rights. You're avoiding most of these emissions that we talked about without even trying. I mean, of course you're trying, but you're cultivating outside for all kinds of reasons, and you have this giant benefit that you're not really given credit for. But also be sustainable, of course, because sustainability isn't just using less energy. It's all your additives, your solid waste, the water. So growing outside in itself isn't a pass. And of course, outdoor growing has had much more bad PR than indoor has, because of irresponsible cultivation. So be proud, be sustainable. I think the big tagline is transparency. It's just, again, this information isn't out there enough. The decision makers, the consumers don't have it. And so education and engagement, consumers obviously need to know. There's huge value for market pull, for people voting with their wallets, especially if you can't get regulators off the dime, or there's conflicts of interest, or, you know, information being suppressed. Educate the consumers. You know, people are more and more voting with their consumption habits, but they can't unless they know, and they don't know. I mean, what would you think? You know, 1 in 1,000 cannabis consumers or less probably really understands what we're talking about today. And then there's the bud tenders who, again, I think Jeremy said, are really not literate and not competent to explain to their customers. And instead, they steer consumption towards the high carbon product. Investors is another one. You know, it's something I want to do now is really analyze the business models and look at, you know, what is the bottom line for in versus out, especially tomorrow? If there is sustainability, how does that change the bottom line if you have all that solar, right? If you're recovering water, if you're doing all these things right, if you're buying LEDs, a lot of pushback against LEDs by indoor growers. They're very expensive. And what's the ROI on that? So I think the investment business case needs to be made better as cannabis companies, indoor cannabis companies, start to come into green funds and socially responsible funds. Boy, those fund managers who are picking those stocks, they need to be educated that this is not necessarily something that they want in their portfolios. And then environmental organizations, you know, you've probably noticed how quiet they are in this. Who has ever seen Greenpeace or the World Wildlife Fund or the Natural Resources Defense Council talk about this issue? Nature Conservancy has begun a bit. They have a really good program manager there who started to fund and be a participant as a scientist herself in analyzing both indoor and outdoor environmental impacts. And last but not least are politicians. And this is the last slide. What to do? You know, they are largely uninformed, but also the lobby, of course, I don't need to tell you, for indoor producers is much stronger than the, you know, much more well-resourced, I shouldn't say stronger, but more well-resourced than an organization like yours can be. And, you know, I think a lot of the regulators are captive by this, either consciously or subconsciously. And even organizations who are promoting green cannabis indoors or outdoors are also not necessarily truly neutral or giving the full story, you know, to their constituencies. So meanwhile, we have now a new president who is putting climate change front and center, and he's also probably going to be putting cannabis legalization front and center. And that is an enormous train wreck that I don't think they're aware of, that's an impending train wreck that they're not aware of. And so I think that message to Washington that you can't just do one of these without looking at the other. Now, fortunately, it's not a real choice between cannabis legalization and climate, but because outdoor cultivation can be done with quality and sustainability. But that's not going to happen by itself. And there are certain levers that the feds can consciously pull as they move forward with on both those fronts, but they've got to do it. They've got to be deliberate about it. And so I think that's the last but not least, you know, challenge that we all have in front of us. So that's my remarks. I'm at 23 minutes, a little over. Sorry, Crystal, but
oh, you're
covered it. And happy to take any questions or tomatoes or whatever folks have to offer back my direction. Thanks for listening. And Crystal's got the slides, and you're welcome to share them around with people.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Mills. Now, if you have any questions, feel free to post those in the chat box on Zoom or in the comments section on Facebook. It does look like we have a question here on Zoom from Jade with Puffin Farms. And so her question was, have you spoken to any regulators or politicians that have taken an interest in this issue? Do you think there is any hope to deal with this issue via policy as national legalization rolls out?
Thanks, Jade. I have a bit, you know, I've had inquiries, and then you never know who reads, you know, what you write. But nothing highly promising. You know, there's interest, but they're very harried. They have a lot of different people talking in their ear about this. So, you know, one person can't can't do all the education. You and others really need to get out there. I do think there's hope. But unfortunately, there are things like, and I'm very unpopular in this regard among my own peers, but typically energy policy and sustainable energy policy is about things like rebates for more efficient behavior technology, or it's about standards, codes and standards for buildings. And when your only tool is a hammer and you look, see all your problems as nails, that's kind of the situation we have here, that they're looking at energy efficient building codes and rebates for things like LED lighting. And I find those actually not only counterproductive, but bordering on immoral and unethical, because they actually hurt your industry, right? They're subsidies to indoor producers that are not kind of counterbalanced with subsidies to outdoor production. So they make rebates in particular, obviously, make it more cost effective to grow indoors, and that biases the playing field. So there's efforts to work with policy. I mean, a lot of states are working with these kind of things I'm mentioning. A lot of utilities are looking at rebates, but I think they're misunderstanding the market dynamics. They're used to things that can't be done outside, right? You have a hospital, you want to make an energy efficient hospital, you don't take all the patients out into the parking lot and turn off the air conditioning. You improve the building. But this is just so different. I can see one from Andrew. Do you want me to look at that?
Yeah, actually, we have one that came in through Facebook first, so let's go with that one from Dave Whiteside. And so his question is, are Washington cannabis farmers incentivized by tax breaks or so forth to use outdoor sustainable green growing methods? And I can say in Washington they aren't, but, you know, Evan, what do you think that would look like if we were to incentivize outdoor production?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And of course, you and your members can speak better. I don't know that we have 50 different policy landscapes. That's part of the problem, is patchwork. And so what's happening, you know, just a footnote there, the answer to that question, many are disincentivized. Illinois forbids outdoor production, full stop. It's against the law to grow outside. In California, about half the counties forbid outdoor cultivation. So there are actually disincentives more than there are incentives. I think, you know, one of the things is the interstate transportation laws, obviously. Why should we be growing cannabis in Fargo, North Dakota, in the middle of the winter? You know, well, because Fargo customers can only consume cannabis grown by North Dakota growers. So that's obviously a federal policy issue. Doubling down on the black market and other things that cause an oversupply and push down the prices of your product more so, I'm told, than they push down the price of indoor. So that, again, makes you less profitable, but it's an artificial, you know, it's something that the policymakers can help remedy. There's this thing, for those of you who are old enough, called the carbon tax, and that's always been this incredibly unpopular thing, but maybe that'll come back, or some other form of that. We don't charge for energy in a commensurate way with its impacts on public health, on air quality, on ecosystems, on natural disasters, and so the price of energy and the subsidies for energy. Now, Biden administration is looking at eliminating subsidies on fossil fuels, which is a very potent and very important thing to do, and that will trickle down to the cannabis industry, actually. And then, you know, there's a whole dynamic between states' rights or states' jurisdiction and federal, and I don't pretend to understand that here, but there's certain things that the states can't, that the feds can't do, or they have to defer to the states. But the feds can still, we've been down this road before, the feds can still develop model standards, model policies, model programs, and make them easy to adopt, you know, by states, and cooperate with that. And I think one of the other last things is disclosure, just back to this slide, like there needs to be more transparency. And there's a lot of work that's been done with energy use disclosure requirements, usually not at the federal level, more at the state level. But again, that's a policy pathway to just make all this more visible. So I hope that's responsive a bit to the question.
Okay, and I guess let's go with Andrew's question here. What's the best statistic to share about indoor cannabis that helps illustrate how much power is consumed by indoor in contrast to sun-grown?
Well, I think there's no one best metric because there's all these different audiences, right? There's these different entities that, you know, you see on this slide. And so I think the messaging really needs to be tailored to who's being communicated to. The ones that are in my earlier slide, which again, Crystal, you can send around, are our top ones to use. If you pull up the 2012 paper, there's a bunch more equating it to how many houses and cross-country road trips and things like that. But it really just depends who your audience is.
Okay, and then I have a question on Facebook from Mark Ambler. What do you think about the potential for a demand response program with indoor and grid operators?
Well, they can and should be done, but again, that's lipstick on a pig to me. It's just, you've got this problem, and we have, it sounds like the person who asked the question is conversant about that whole issue. This is about the time of day that energy is used as opposed to the absolute amount. And some measures reduce the absolute amount and shift it around. But that's just barking up the wrong tree for this. We need to get it outside. We have enough demand that needs to be moved around already without creating yet more demand. And this is a particularly kind of difficult sector to do it with, because you can't interrupt those 12 hours. You can't interrupt those 18 hours without you're hurting the crop. And so, you know, there are things that can be done, but it's kind of a red herring here. Demand response is not the solution.
All right. And that looks like that's all we have for questions. Thank you so much, Dr. Mills.
My pleasure.
Have you.
All right. Welcome back. And it was great to have Dr. Evan Mills on there. I have to say, he was one of the first people I interviewed, Dig, back when I got writing on cannabis back in 2014. So it's great to have him on the show finally. And he was here speaking at the Washington State Sun Growers Cup. And that was Crystal Oliver doing the question and answer segment there. I'd like to thank her for giving us permission to use the audio there of the Sun Growers Association. And some really good information there. So one thing that I have started doing when I go to the cannabis store, Dig, and it doesn't always work out because they don't always know what I'm talking about. But I always try to either get light deprivation or sun-grown cannabis. And I have actually started doing that. Now, I do have a couple brands that I do like, Washington Bud Company and Trailblazing, and some other brands that I do like that are indoor. But I do know some, and if indoor brands are good, but you want to look for the ones that are being responsible and try to do the right thing. But I think it can make a difference down here on the consumer level if people start asking for more outdoor or light deprivation cannabis.
Yes. I outdoor and light dep. And for anyone who doesn't know, light dep very simply is you cover the plant earlier in the day to simulate darkness earlier, so it'll go into flower sooner, so you could have an extra crop. So that's how you're getting early outdoor. Or they're using auto flowers. But outdoor grown cannabis is better for the environment. And, you know, they talked about that. It's less energy intensive. And that's why home grow is so important. If a state forces cultivation indoors, indoor cultivation on a smaller scale is better than on a larger scale. And outdoor cultivation is always ideal for the environments, and I would argue for proper terpene development.
Yeah, and they've talked about, it's a misnomer that outdoor cannabis is not as good as indoor. Although indoor cannabis can really show off a little bit, you can get some really good outdoor cannabis. And so let's everybody try to be environmentally responsible out there in the cannabis world. I know it's hard, and there are coming out with some recyclable tubes for joints and things like that. So the industry is catching up a little bit. I know one of the big problems here in Washington is the plastic and everything. So all that's getting better.
I try to reuse joint tubes I get from dispensaries for home rolled stuff and stuff like that. But it's hard, you know. You get a pre-roll and you get this plastic tube, and you end up, you know, if you consume a fair amount, you eventually end up with 50 of them.
So let's move on to our last segment of the show, and that's our It's a Bust, and that's straight out of Oregon. And so tell us a little bit about this one. Somebody had a big, massive grow, and government didn't like that.
So someone had a legal cannabis grow, and then someone also had on that same property a little further back from the road, it sounds like an extra illegal grow. And they don't make it completely clear in the article, but the entire place had about 140 large greenhouses and somewhere between 40,000 and 50,000 plants. Now, they sent the sheriffs out here. It was a raid. And they detained three people. Now, this article is tagline from May 27th, and it's, you know, mid-June now, and I am not seeing an update on whether charges were filed. So what might have happened might have actually not been a drug enforcement thing. It might have been a code problem with how many plants they were growing. And maybe it wasn't as a big deal as this article makes it out. For people who haven't been known someone who's been on one of these drug raids or anything, they've changed a little bit. They still come in very hot, but a lot of times when they detain people, they let them go on scene and cited with a court date. They don't even take them to jail. So it's and then sometimes they don't destroy all the plants. Sometimes they just make them cut down the extras. So basically, it's a waste of police resources when it could easily be accomplished by a code enforcement officer. There's no reason to send an army of cops out there when really, you know, a code officer and maybe one sheriff's deputy can go have the conversation and figure out what needs to be done. It's just a gross overreaction by a local sheriff's department that's probably starving for revenue now that they can't bust grows as often.
Yeah, totally agree. And so that is our show for today. Thanks everybody for tuning in. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can send over an email to info@radiotacoma.org and they will get the email over to us. Or folks can listen to Dig on his own podcast. Tell us a little bit about your Gmail and how to listen to your podcast, Dig.
Yeah. If you want to contact me, you can contact me at UncleDig4@gmail.com. You can also find me on any of your favorite podcatchers. I have a podcast called Bagseed Chronicles with Uncle Dig, and it's cannabis focused. It's mostly home grow focused, but we also interview other people in the cannabis industry, and it's just all things cannabis. And I'd love to have you come over and check it out.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH Radio Tacoma. Thank you.